All right, so last week we finished up with Savonarola. We were looking at some of the early reform efforts, and what we were looking at were those who were inside the church. Today we're going to look at some who are outside of the church, outside in terms of not having official sort of status or roles within the church, like most of the men that we talked about before were either priests or monks or something of that sort. So the first group, and some of these you will know, although it might take a little bit. Christian mystics. So mysticism, we sometimes cringe at mysticism, but there is a there's a real part of our understanding of what it means to be a follower of Christ has been shaped by these Christian mystics. And we'll talk about what that means in a moment. But those who did a great deal, but in a very quiet way, before the time of Luther to advance the truth, although we wouldn't call them reformers, are this group of mystics. They were sort of like the early hermits who sort of they got it was like a single, and they just kept playing the same song over and over and over again. And there's benefit to that, because eventually, if you listen to something long enough, it becomes part of who you are. I mean, Wendy and I marvel all the time. We'll be driving, the radio's on, a song comes on that we haven't heard for 45 years, and we know every word. It's really remarkable. And so in a very quiet way, this group really did a lot and had an influence on Luther particularly. Against the claim that God is known and mediated through the clergy and through the sacraments, which was the song of the church, mysticism tended to stress a more personal and immediate experience with God. And one of the doors that they opened up was this notion that the priesthood is every believer. It's not just an elite class of men who are called to be priests, but that God calls all of us to be priests before Him. Priests not in the Old Testament sense of animal sacrifice, but in the New Testament sense of sacrifices of praise, sacrifices of giving, sacrifices of thanksgiving. Those are the things that we are now called. Well, ultimately, as Paul says in Romans 12, the sacrifice of our very lives, right? Present your bodies, a living sacrifice. So in that sense, they really opened the door to this. Mystics were not sufficiently numerous or well organized to be a real threat to the church. So for most of the Middle Ages, as they're developing, the church just ignored them because they weren't significant numbers. However, as some strong leaders emerged toward the end of the Middle Ages, that all changed. They particularly studied the New Testament and especially the life of Christ. So they wanted to model their relationship with God in light of Christ. So the first one we're going to look at is Meister Eckhart. He was born in Saxon, and he became a very famous preacher. He was quite dynamic. 2 years after he died, Pope John the 22nd condemned 28 of his statements as heretical. They couldn't do much about him, but they could at least burn most of his books and sermons. The next guy we're going to talk about was his disciple, and he actually kept some of the sermons, put his own name on them so that it preserved some of the teachings, and some of those ended up in Luther's possession. And Luther was, again, Luther was influenced by it. Perhaps the most famous saying of Meister Eckhart was this: the cost of inaction is far greater than the cost of making a mistake. Yes?
Do we have those 28 statements?
We do not. Right, we do not have them. My suspicion is that they were too Protestant, and so that's why they were condemned. Because he probably was adding his voice to anti-papacy, anti-sacramental, you know, those kinds of things. I thought that was a great quote, though. The cost of inaction is far greater than the cost of making a mistake. And often we are inactive because we're afraid of making a mistake. And the reality is, we make mistakes all the time. In fact, that's one of the best ways we learn, is by mistakes. All right, next guy is John Toller. He was a Dominican, again, a disciple of Eckhart. He wasn't so esoteric as Meister Eckhart was. He was much more practical. So he turns his attention to the practical side of religion. He wasn't overly concerned about the theological, although he did study the theology. I mean, theology, it's not as if theology isn't important to these guys. It was that theology, there are two types of theology. There is the theology that we study, but what that does is then that gives or should give us a orthodox practical theology. I mean, everything we do is theological.
Theory and practice.
Right, that's right. Yeah, it was orthodoxy is right doctrine. Orthopraxis is right practice, and they need to go together. Because if you end up sort of wavering on either one of those, it has an effect on the other, okay? He stressed God's indwelling with the human soul. Again, something that the Roman Catholic Church did not and continues not to do too much today, that God's mediation comes primarily through the church from the Roman Catholic position. So he's stressing God's indwelling of the human soul, the practice of virtues, or disciplines, which is also going to be very influential in the sort of the development of the Protestant Reformation. He particularly stressed humility and seeking God's will. Because again, in the Roman Catholic Church, if I want to know what God's will is for my life, how do I find that out? Ask the priest. I go to the priest and I ask the priest, what is God's will for my life? And what these men are beginning to show us is that the best place to find God's will is God's word, right? This is a very dangerous movement in evangelicalism today. This notion that one should follow their heart. I see it all the time. I hear it all the time. The heart is desperately wicked. And we can't ever forget that. We can't follow our hearts because it's going to lead us to places we shouldn't go. We need to follow God's word. Okay? The Friends of God. This was a group of Christian mystics in the 14th century, 1300s, most of whom lived along the Rhine River. Their concern was Bible study, which again is, nobody was studying the Bible at this point, certainly not lay people. Lay people didn't have access to the Bible, they didn't have any desire to know the Bible. They just simply came and heard whatever the priest told them, and that's what they were supposed to believe. So this group began to emphasize Bible study and fellowship. The word fellowship in Greek is koinonia. We understand that in our sort of in our world today, in the Christian world today. This idea that God, although I would say the evangelical church doesn't really understand it because they still put too much emphasis on personal relationship with God. Not that that's not important. Please don't go home and say, man, our preacher doesn't think we should have a personal relationship with God. That's not what I'm saying. But evangelicalism puts too much emphasis on personal relationship at the cost of fellowship. Because God doesn't save us individually. God saves us into his Son, which is his body, which is the church. So we can't lose sight of fellowship here. And so this group is really instrumental in beginning to plow that ground to help the people understand what is the church. As we get to Protestantism, we'll see that that plays a significant role. Yeah, Ted. Correct. They were learned. That's right. They were. They were all learned men, and that was a benefit. And if you were learned in that day, you learned Latin. You understood how to read Latin. So that wasn't the issue. But from the church's perspective, they weren't supposed to be doing that because they were laymen. They weren't ordained. Therefore, the secrets, the mysteries of God shouldn't have been given to them. That's only what's given to the church, okay? Out of this group came a book called German Theology, which was appreciated by Luther. Luther mentions it several times in some of his writings. And that book, do I have that up here? No. That book deals with the goal of spiritual perfection. Not in the way that John Wesley would have taught perfection, as if perfection is possible in this life. But we are all in the process or all have the goal of spiritual perfection, do we not? What do we call that theologically? Sanctification, right? The process of being made holy. And if I ultimately become holy, like God is holy, then I am well, I am perfect, okay? Not perfect in the same sense that God is perfect, but perfect in the sense that I am without sin, okay? And that's the goal of sanctification, all right?
Was there a particular reason that most of these Protestant movements all came out of the Habsburg Empire?
Is there a reason why this all these movements all came out of the Habsburg Empire? I think so because the Germans were the most learned in the world. They were the most learned in the world.
More educational resources.
Correct, yes. And part of that is because of the work of Charlemagne, who is not of that house, but is the first Holy Roman Emperor. And he puts an emphasis on education within the Holy Roman Empire. And at this point, the Holy Roman Empire is really relegated to a small part of what is Germany. And so there, education is very, very much esteemed. The ways that they did this, or the book, German Theology, it deals with three different things. The first is purification, and they understood purification to come through the process of repentance, right? Repentance means confession of sin and turning away from sin, okay? The second was enlightenment, which is really going to play a significant role in American evangelicalism, because our understanding of what Christianity is has been shaped not only by the Protestant Reformation, but by French Enlightenment, for good or ill. And those ideas were beginning to germinate, if you will, during this time, sort of pre-Renaissance. But as the Renaissance begins, Enlightenment really comes along. We have the whole Christian humanism that we talked about. Did we talk about that? No, we're going to talk about that in a moment. So I won't go there yet. And then the third is union, that we are united with Christ, that there is a spiritual bond that we have with Christ that allows us to be transformed. And also, ultimately, they would see that as purity of heart, right? That someday we will be able to follow our hearts. And it's why God says that he will give us the desires of our heart. Again, it's not that whatever my heart thinks he'll give me, it's that he'll give me right desires. That's the process of sanctification, all right? And we're all on that road together. Some of us are further behind, and some of us are a little further ahead, but we're all on that road. And one day we'll all cross the finish line because Christ has already crossed it for us, okay? All right, next group. Brethren of the common life. These are your folk. This group developed in the Low Countries and were pioneers of the Reformation in the Netherlands. I'm sure you've read some of these or had them even in school. They were founded by Gerard de Grote. Okay. Sounds like I have a cold. and what they did was they were establishing schools, they encouraged education, they encouraged service to the sick, so they saw ministry as not just theological training, but practical living. That the Christian life was about the life that we live. The most famous of their schools was in, how do I say?
Deventer.
Okay. And it was here in Deventer that Erasmus, that we'll meet in a few moments, and many other outstanding humanists and scholars studied during the Reformation or pre-Reformation. So it was a significant place that would give rise to sort of this idea or this notion of the hallmarks of the Reformation. The most famous of the brethren of the common life was a man named Thomas a Kempis. How many of you have read The Imitation of Christ? Shame on you. It really is a delightful little book. And it's little, okay? You can find it online. I would encourage you to read it. I mean, you have to read it with discerning eyes, as you should read anything. I mean, anything you read, you should be reading with discerning eyes. But it was the most influential Christian book that came out of the Christian mysticism. And it's still in print today. You can still find it, I was going to say at the Christian bookstore, but I saw Lifeway is closing all of their stores, so which I'm not altogether unhappy about, but that's another story altogether. The book emphasizes peace of soul, and that is that if I have a relationship with God through Christ, that I can have true peace. So it emphasizes peace. It emphasizes purity of thought and simplicity of life. And it tended to make religion personal. It minimized, and this is where I would say the discernment really has to come in, it minimized formal Christianity. And you know, we read that, or people in our sort of modern culture reading it, read that and say, see, I don't have to be a part of the church in order to be a Christian. And I would say, well, maybe. But the reality is they emphasized that because it was actually dangerous to be part of the church, because the church was teaching false doctrine. Okay? And so their emphasis on the importance of personal religion really was a statement against the church. Because then, you know, there was only one church. It wasn't like, you know, if I don't like what's going on here, I can go down the road and find another one. which is one of the real detriments to the Protestant Reformation, by the way. It's a real detriment. Yes?
I don't know if somewhere I've lost thought along the way, but, I mean, back in that day, there was only a Catholic Church?
Yes.
Is that it?
There was only a Catholic Church. Well, essentially, that's the way it always was, right? So you had
synagogues in Jerusalem way back in the Old Testament time. When,
I'm not following your...
Well, I don't know. I guess I'm not following myself. But it just seems like from when Adam and Eve came about, it's always been the Catholic Church.
Well, no. So in the Old Testament, you had one church, and that was called Israel. All right, and Israel was primarily built around temple worship, although in the probably 200 to 300 years before Christ, you see the it was more than that. It was about 500 or 600 years because it developed out of the Babylonian captivity. They began to realize, well, I can't get to the temple, so we're going to gather together in these synagogues. And so synagogue worship sort of developed out of the Babylonian captivity, became part of, but they were still all part of one church, which was Israel. Jesus comes and establishes his church, which is now not ethnic, but made up of every tribe, tongue, and peoples. And so then you have one church. At that point, it's just the church. You had a Latin flavor, that part that was developing out of Rome, and you had a Greek part that was developing out of Jerusalem and the eastern area, okay? And eventually, in 1054, those churches came apart. So the reality is the world at this point has two churches. It has the Roman Catholic Church and it has the Orthodox Church. Christian churches, yes. Two Christian churches. Yes, Ted.
Weren't the Anabaptists also at that time?
No, they would tell you that they were, but they were not. We'll get to them eventually, okay? Yeah, it's those Dutch. We got to watch out for those Dutch. Because they were the leaders of that movement. They certainly were. Simon Menno. Menno Simons, but yeah, he in English we put Menno's, yeah.
His dad's name was Simon. That's why.
So he's Menno Simons,
yep.
Of Simon.
Pastor?
Yes.
Did the Roman Catholic Church morph out of a pagan based religion?
No.
No, it did not.
Did
you hear that?
Okay. Yeah, no. One of the criticisms of Roman Catholicism, and I think it's a valid criticism, and we'll talk about that particularly in the Counter-Reformation, because as the Reformation, as Protestantism begins to spread throughout the world, the Roman Catholics realize, hey, we actually need to react to this. We need to clean up our own house. And then you have Christian mission, Roman Catholic mission. And in Roman Catholic mission, what happened is you had syncretism, where they would come into an area and they would see the pagan people doing certain things and they would, I don't want to say adopt, but they would take that and and merge it together to sort of help the people be Christian. And that, I think, is a valid criticism of Roman Catholicism. We do the same thing, by the way. We just aren't as astute or aware of it. We incorporate pagan ideas into our Christian life all the time.
Kind of like where you walk in and say, well, that unnamed God is the one I'm going to tell you about.
Yes, sort of like that, yes. All right, did I answer your question?
Yeah,
okay.
I forgot
where we were.
History.
Yeah. As I used to mess with my Baptist kids all the time when I was teaching them, I would remind them they are Catholics. We are Catholics. We believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic church. We are Catholics. We're just not Roman Catholics. Yes, Anne?
Were they called Roman Catholics?
No, they were just called Catholics. Okay. They were just Catholics.
It was the Reformation?
Yes, it began, yes. Okay. And they would either refer to them as Romanists or Papists or Sons of Perdition or Sons of the Devil. The Antichrist. We'll talk about some of those as well. We're in the 1400s, 1300s, 1400s, okay? All right, Christian humanism. Again, whenever we see the word humanism, the hair on the back of our necks goes up and we bristle a little bit, but that's because our interaction with humanism is almost exclusively Christian humanism. And that has not always been the case. So we have this development of Christian humanism. And really, it developed, it's hard to say, did Christian humanism bring the Renaissance or did the Renaissance bring Christian humanism? And I think the answer is yes. Which came first, the chicken or the egg, right? Now, we all know that it had to be the chicken because God made the chicken and then the chicken. But you know what I'm saying. So during the later part of the Middle Ages, learning is becoming more prevalent. During the call it the Dark Ages because primarily there were a limited number of people who were actually literate. But that's changing in the Renaissance, and that's going to have a profound impact on the Reformation because these ideas have been coming. The ideas that Luther had aren't new ideas, but they came at a time when people couldn't read, didn't understand, had no means or mechanism to sort of take those. 1450, we have the invention of the printing press. Right. I mean, you had to wait 3 months while a monk, hand copied it out. Where the printing press makes books available to people, and along with that, you have more and more people who are becoming literate, and all of that is sort of taking shape to in some sense, God is orchestrating. Well, I know God is orchestrating all of this, but when you look at it, you see all of the pieces coming together so that when Luther shows up on the scene, everything is in place for this mighty wind that is going to blow through Europe, okay, and ultimately the whole world. Learning at this point is being reoriented towards the study of classical Greek and Latin literature. Much of Europe had lost a lot of the Greek and Roman or Latin literature before this. Most of what they had was in a library in Alexandria. What happened to the library in Alexandria? Burned to the ground. And so there was very little of that was preserved in the West. But Persian scholars, Muslims, they preserved it. And for that, we ought to be very, very thankful, right? Muslims today aren't like Muslims then. Today they would have just destroyed all of Western literature. But then they preserved it. And because they preserved it, it's making its way through the Iberian Peninsula, through Spain, because the Moors are there. And the Moors have a fairly cordial relationship with the Christians in Spain and the Jews in Spain. And so there is sharing of this ancient literature, and it finds its way back into Europe that way. And that really changes the culture. Yes?
It was filling a void because there wasn't any other literature. You got people now learn to read, and there's nothing for them to read.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah, and so they just devoured it, and so the Renaissance really gives rise to this. Petrarch is really the first outstanding Italian humanist during this period. He lived 1304 to 1374, and he reveals a difference of attitude in the way that he approaches life that is going to, again, shape the Reformation. It is said of him, he climbed the mountain not to do penance, but to see the scenery. And we sort of chuckle at that, but it was a new perspective. The idea that you would just simply go somewhere to enjoy God's creation was not a part of the Roman Catholic Church, because you couldn't find penance there anyway. You had to go to the church, okay? The change can be seen most starkly in the art during the time. In the Middle Ages, everything was dominated by the church. If you look at art in the Middle Ages, almost everything is some sort of saint or religious depiction of something. During this time of the Renaissance, art becomes more individualistic. It dwells on detail rather than some of the, I laugh when I see all the saints and they all have halos over their heads, and you know, it doesn't deal in realism. There is an effort to show the beauty of nature and human nature. So Christian humanism is really sort of getting back to this idea that God invested in his creation beauty, and these men and women during this time are seeking to find that. They're seeking to find beauty. Okay? Artists stopped painting ethereal figures of saints and angels and started painting human beings the way they were. All of a sudden we have actual portraits. In some of the earlier figures that we've looked at, you know, I go back and I look to find pictures. Of course, it's all paintings. And some of them are comical, because there was never an attempt to make them real. There was an attempt to make them ethereal or otherworldly or something like that, okay? Geographers stopped publishing maps with imaginary places and mythical beasts and actually started publishing detailed maps. So we have cartography developing during this time, where you could actually get a map, and I am a geography junkie. Yeah, nerd. That would be the word. And I marvel at the detail and accuracy of maps. They didn't have a satellite overhead that takes a picture. They figured it out by their own movements. And it's truly stunning when you start seeing the detail of that. Yes? Yes, they were. Yes, they were. Well, they understood astronomy much better than we did. And so they were able to use the stars to figure out locations. You know, they were much more learned, much, much more learned in the Persian world than was the West.
Although it wasn't widely distributed. It wasn't the population.
Oh, no, right. Yes, right. You very much had a class system in the East, very much so. Scholars then begin to study original texts and original languages. If you're receiving Greek books and Latin books, you need to understand, because these are Latin books that aren't written in ecclesiastical Latin, they're written in classical Latin, so you need to understand classical Latin. You have books that are written in Greek, and it's not even Koine Greek. It's classical Greek. And so you have to begin to understand the language. So there's a study of languages that develops at this point, which again is going to drive the Reformation. The hallmark of the Reformation, we have the five solas, but really the hallmark of the Reformation was ad fontes, to the source. Right, fountain means source, to the source. So if I am going to take the scriptures and I am going to put them in the language of the people, I'm not going to get a copy of the Latin Vulgate and translate it. I'm going to seek to find the most accurate Greek and Hebrew manuscripts that I can find. And so now you have a desire for discovery of these things. I mean, it's just, the world is turning upside down at this point. You're going to see exploration, you're going to see study, you're going to see art. All of those things are just exploding in the world, and all of that opens the door for the Protestant Reformation. And for that, we ought to be very thankful. The invention of the printing press around 1450 greatly aids this movement. When we get to Luther, and we're not going to get to him today, I apologize. It did set the world on fire because they could print massive amounts of things. With few exceptions, do I have that? Yes. Okay, so the scholars who rediscovered classical civilization were called humanists because they were more interested in the study of the humanities, right? Their emphasis was on man, on man's deeds, on man's thoughts, on man's dignity. Again, they're not taking out of the equation God. But what they're understanding is that there is this imago Dei. There is an image of God in man, and therefore it's appropriate for us to study the humanities. Right? How many of you went to a liberal arts college? Okay? You're indebted to the Reformation and or to the Renaissance because they opened up that world. I was a head of school at a classical Christian school, and I was meeting with a guy who was, he dealt with homeschoolers, and he invited me to come and speak. And after I spoke, he got up and he said, "Well, if I go to the doctor, I don't care if my doctor knows Shakespeare." He was jabbing. And I said, "I do, because I want somebody who understands me as a human being, not just as a bunch of cells that are joined together. He needs to understand God has made us body and soul, and part of that means that there's an expression of arts and literature. And so I want a doctor who is well-rounded, not just somebody who understands biology." Okay? He never invited me back. Oh, well.
If we take God out of the equation here, that's how we get our present definition of humanism.
Yes. You take God out of that picture and you end up with secular humanism or atheistic. It really is atheistic humanism. There is no God. There is only humanity. Right, and that's so. Again, it's not the humanism part; it's the secular part, the atheistic humanism. With few exceptions, the Italian humanists did not concern themselves with the gospel. They were Italy never is going to be impacted significantly by the Reformation. And the church, most of Italy, again, there is no Italy, right? It's just a bunch of city-states, if you will, with a huge chunk of land right in the middle called the Papal States. So you have this enormous influence of the Roman Catholic Church. And many of these humanists that develop during this time are families that are very, very connected to the Roman Catholic Church. They're influential in actually propping up popes, right? You have several families that play a significant role. I was watching something and there was an advertisement for something else and they were talking about the Medicis. And that was one of the most prominent families in Italy during this time. However, as the Renaissance spreads from Italy, it really gets its start in Italy, as it spreads out from Italy into Germany, into the Netherlands and England, it has a much greater religious concern and it creates a desire to study the scriptures and to study the scriptures not in the Latin Vulgate, but in the Greek and Hebrew original language. There's a new emphasis on reading and studying the church fathers, which is going to shape Luther and Calvin, because they begin to really immerse themselves in many of these early fathers who were orthodox, who were teaching right doctrine, and they begin to understand that it was the church that had drifted away from that, not the early fathers, okay? Because for the Roman Catholic Church, I mean, they can hold two very different ideas, because for them, if you have truth here, and then somebody comes along in the church tradition and says, well, this is the truth, then you adopt that, you never bother undoing what you did before. You just embrace a new thought. That was what we talked about, Abelard, seek et non, yes and no, right? And he was pointing out all of these sort of, you have two disparate ideas that are being held. And again, the Roman Catholic Church didn't really care to have those drawn. So you have a greater religious concern, a desire to study the scriptures and the fathers. This is often called Christian humanism. Although humanism was not identical with the Reformation, it shaped it. All right? Yes?
Would you say that in more modern terms, Vince Peale or Robert Schuller were humanists?
Yes, they were humanists. And they would have been Christian humanists. Except they weren't driven by orthodoxy. They were driven more by humanism, more by human potential, more by Enlightenment philosophy, right? Where the Enlightenment, unhinged from Christianity, says that humanity is progressing. It is getting better. It is evolving, which is going to open the door in the 19th century for evolution. All of these, you can't, it's a train, right? And you can't just unhinge a compartment. They're all connected together. And so they very much, you know, Peale and Schuller were really the last bastions of modernism, because they really don't have a lot of followers today, because of we live in a postmodern age, and so. But they were very much about human potential.
Well, it went from the early forms that you're talking about here, where Christianity was shaping the humanism, and now it's switched to where the humanism is shaping the Christianity.
Correct. Right. They're more humanist than Christian. All right. We will stop there. We'll start looking next week at some humanists. We only have four of them to look at very briefly, and then we'll get to Luther. We will get to Luther next week, I promise. All right, any other thoughts, questions? I know that you're probably not as excited about this as me, but this is what we do today is directly connected to this. It's just unbelievable when you start, you know, even when we looked at some of the ways that that government was viewed, those are shaping what we now embrace today. I mean, so there are lots of those kinds of things, all right?
Can I ask a dumb question?
There are no dumb questions.
Well, yes. Never mind.
Okay, if we teach this in seminary, how do we get all of this splintery stuff? Because most of the church in America are pastored by men who have never been to seminary. They've never been to seminary, right? A church sees a guy or a gal that shows some promise, and they ordain them, and next thing you know, they're preaching. There's no guidance. Much of mainline Christianity in America, they don't teach this, right? One of the things I learned very early on in seminary was that liberal liberal seminaries only taught liberal theology. Conservative seminaries taught conservative theology or orthodox theology and liberal theology. We had to read both, and I think that's important. And so we, which is why the Presbyterian Church particularly has been at the forefront of this sort of thought. Most of our seminaries are leading the way in evangelical Christian thought in America today. If you look at any of the scholars, most of them are PCA, OPC, our ilk, okay? And I think that's why. Yes, Joel.
I want you to know we're enjoying this as much as you're enjoying it.
Good. We'll really have some fun with Luther. He is a character. Oh, man, he is a character. All right, let's pray.